Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast. And today's discussing episode, we are going to be discussing pre-Roman Britain. Yes, we are going to be looking at Bruton drama, I believe is the term. We'll get more on that in a moment. The early stuff of history. And we're going to maybe dive into the question of what is history and what is a history play, and all of the angles around various plays that we have looked at on the podcast, on our exploring sessions over on the YouTube channel, specifically plays like Gorboduc, Locrine, Lear, and a play that I don't think we've actually released yet, but we've definitely looked at Nobody and Somebody. But there are quite a lot of plays from the early part of English history that is already in the early modern period a somewhat contested site. And my guest is here to talk about that, specifically in reference to their book, Staging Britain's Past, Pre-Roman Britain in Early Modern Drama, a copy of which I have here. It is reassuringly expensive and is a very enjoyable read, actually. And just for the record, I bought this myself. I am not being paid to promote these things this time. So I'll ask my guest to introduce himself. Who are you and what is your purpose in life?
I'm Kim Gilchrist. I am a lecturer in English literature. Specifically, I'll say the word once and I won't say it again, Shakespeare studies and early modern drama and theatre history at University of Cardiff. That's who I am.
Yes, I say we're our focus is on these early plays, these early history plays. Some of them are early history plays, but they're also about early history. Just to go into this question of what is the history that these plays are bouncing off?
Okay, yeah. Well, this is sort of what was fascinating for me about this subject. This was the subject of my PhD and subsequently my book. So I've been thinking about this for quite a significant number of years by now. Very broadly speaking, by the early modern period, the period of all the plays that you'll be looking at and that I study, ideas of British history, and I'm going to say British history because this is the reasons for that will become apparent. Although it was, you're quite right, essentially an English history. It was invented in England, usually to the benefit of the English, was transforming, was changing, was essentially kind of eroding. There was this tradition of history, pre-Roman history, sort of 1,000 years before the Romans came to Britain. Britain was believed to have been founded by a Trojan exile called Brutus sometimes, who came here with his sort of diasporic sort of group of exiled Trojans and conquered the giants of the island of Albion, as it was then called. Killed them all and founded a city called Troynovant, New Troy, and ruled disastrously, often chaotically, Britain for a good 1,000 years before the Romans arrived. This was a historical tradition that was broadly believed by, let's say, probably most people up until through the medieval period, up until the time that we're all interested in, when a few historians or sort of historiographers started prodding it a bit and saying, well, hang on, if there's this glorious sort of British sort of antiquity where at one point one of the kings was meant to have conquered Rome, why don't any other historians from other countries mention it? King Arthur was thrown into this, by the way. And it started being questioned and it didn't really stand up. And broadly speaking, this sort of widely believed tradition of many, many sort of King Lear's one of these kings, it fell to pieces. I'm simplifying, but it had been invented by a lay cleric called Geoffrey of Monmouth, quite a famous name, in probably the early 12th century. And through the sort of the peculiarities of history, I guess, had spread out into popular culture over the following centuries to sort of be absorbed in the way that people wouldn't have questioned the idea of King Lear being a historical king or Gorboduc being a historical king or Locrine being a historical figure. The way that we wouldn't question what we accept as sort of lived history. But it precisely the time that all these plays were being written and performed, that was all falling to bits. And historiographers were getting better at doing history, at checking evidence rather than trusting tradition. and it all crumbles away over about a century, and you're left with nothing. There was nothing. But now we know something of the history of the pre-Roman Britain, but at the time there was simply what one writer at the time called a vast blank on the history of our country. There was just this sort of abyss of empty space where there had been a history. So it's quite a disturbing thing to happen in the sense of national identity, historical, and it severed Britain, England, really, from the idea of being descended from Trojans, which was quite a nice thing to, that sort of put them alongside the Romans and various other sort of, it was quite a noble, honourable, grandiose tradition to have. So it's quite destabilising, I guess. And
because it is embedded, it is embedded in so many texts. I mean, you mentioned Troy Navant.
That's right. You will
hear Troy Navant coming up. Mm-hmm. It comes up in Lord Mayor shows a lot. We've done a lot of civic pageantry.
Absolutely.
And there are you know, conventions that and stories that people would know, not just from theatre or literature, but embedded in the culture of the time. And people discover that none of this is necessarily true.
True. None of it's true. That's absolutely right. I think what's really important about it, wasn't always written about in this way, sort of by scholars maybe, is that you're absolutely right. It saturates popular culture. So it's there in ballads, it's there, as you say, in plays, it's there in almanacs. If you bought an almanac, it would often have a little, you know, one of the most sort of frequently sold common publications of the era. It would often have open with a little timeline of world history with about sort of 12 dates on it, you know, number one, world creators, number two, Garden of Eden, you know, so it goes down like that. And it would often have Brute Fans Britain. It was embedded at that level of sort of, it was just assumed. But what is important at this stage, when you read sort of accounts of this period, is that, because it's often people looking at intellectual history and sort of elite history, they'll say, oh, well, then the historians worked out that it was all a load of nonsense. And everybody shrugged their shoulders, said how silly we were, and moved on. And that's not what happened. There's a huge conflict between the sort of the historiographic avant-garde, people like Camden, who are saying, I've looked at the evidence and I don't think this is true. And they're being very careful about it. And there's a huge resistance to the books are written in support of Brute. It's called unpatriotic not to believe in him. It's seen as sort of being, you know, foreign interference and subterfuge for sort of Britain's glorious history, all this sort of jingoistic, nationalistic kind of stuff. But at another level, for a lot of people, I think they just would have been unaware of these discussions. So I'm interested in, say, a play like Locrine or Nobody and Somebody or Lear, either of the Lears, that you've got different audiences having different experiences at different times, depending on their let's say, their educational background, their social class background. Somebody going to see it, especially if they're from Leicester, Lear was meant to have been King of Leicester, seeing it as a fantastic historical play about British history. Somebody else going, oh, I'm not sure anymore. Somebody told me that this is all made up. And somebody absolutely convinced it's nonsense. And that would depend on your social class and your education. So that these plays are different depending on where you're, what kind of information you had access to, what kind of new ideas about history. And it's deeply destabilizing and sort of, I think, unsettling. I think these plays, even if they're not written with that in mind, they can trigger those kind of responses, if that makes sense. Everyone's having a different experience of history at this time.
Yeah.
And we still do in certain ways. You know?
Well, yes. I mean, history is forever a contested site. But what's really interesting as well is the discontinuity, as it were, in terms of the styles of the plays that we have. It's not some other, you know, history plays where you have a sense of a narrative flow and a sense of stylistic similarity. They're all very, very different. We're primarily for this podcast looking at three into four of these plays. They're written in very different periods of time. There's a good 40 years span between them, and they cover a different part of this narrative. We've got a lost play. I say we've got a lost play. There is a lost play that covers the very early, earliest arrival of Brute as he arrives and kills some giants. And killing giants is something that people, I say, for the on the streets will have seen this kind of thing a lot. The appearance of giants and the fighting of giants is a very visual.
Well, the specific giants that would have appeared in the play of. This play you're talking about, the Conquest of Brute, it's referred to, it's given a couple of different names in Henslowe. The giant, the leader of the giants in that play, or who Brute was meant to have conquered, is called Gogmagog, Gogmagog, however one pronounces it. And that's literally the same name of the giant in the Lord Mayor's pageants, in the London pageants. So, and Corineus, who was the other giant in the pageantry, was the sort of Trojan general who was supposed to have defeated, wrestled Gogmagog to the ground and killed him. So these they're literally the same figures as people would have seen going through the streets in the pageants, you know, annually, I guess.
But then with the plays that we have, there is a sort of through line. And I suppose this is the through line that Jeff, as I think I'll call him, was seeding in these stories, which is don't split up the kingdom, because you could argue all of these plays basically have the same plot, which is don't split up the kingdom. Yeah. But they do them. They do this story in very different ways.
Do you want to talk about, because you mentioned this when we were sort of in our little sort of preamble. Chronologically in terms of the heavy quote history, or chronologically in terms of the plays?
Well, that's,
because as you said earlier, there are different chronologies here that, you know, it gets very
tangled. let's state for the listener the order of which they should go chronologically in terms of the story. So we have the Conquest of Brute, we have Locrine, we have who is literally the next in line after Brute, or Brutus in that play. Then we have a few gaps, and we get to King Lear and his daughter daughters, and then we end up with Gorboduc. But in terms of production, it all kicks off with this quite well-known but not often staged play, Gorboduc, which is one of these milestone plays in the history of drama.
I think it's really significant that, according to the print record and what we actually had, what has actually survived, you know, that we're always, that's always the caveat, is that English sort of verse, Senecan tragedy is inaugurated with a story of, taken from these pre-Roman histories, sort of Geoffrey of Monmouth, which I call Brute, and by the way, there's a whole reason for that, but they do originate with him. That's where these two writers, where, you know, the authors look back to in order to try and find a story that will be persuasive and rhetorically powerful for, you know, the purpose that they're giving it in these sort of these performances they give at the Royal Court and at Whitehall. I mean, you're absolutely right. All these plays do talk about the division of Britain and the sort of disastrous consequences of doing so. They all do it slightly differently. There are also lots of stories in between in Geoffrey of Monmouth that either that weren't staged as far as we know, or which were never published, but we do have lost plays of them. These seem to be the ones that people not only chose to write plays about, but to publish as well. And that's interesting. So other stories were staged or were just ignored, you know, and they weren't interesting.
Because
the stationers, let's say, rather
we know
than
there are other versions of the same story of Gorboduc. We know that,
absolutely,
because, you know, his other title is Ferrex and Porrex, or Porrex and Ferrex.
That's right.
Of which there are other plays have done the same theme.
Well, they're churning these out of the rows in the 1590s. There's a Ferrex and Porrex. There's a Molmutius Dunwallow, great name, which directly, who's the king, who sort of directly follows the 50 years of civil war that come in Gorboduc. And there's a sense of, you know, Thomas Heywood writes about this, but they were putting a collective London-based project to stage the entirety of history, you know, as it was understood at the time. We have patchwork sort of fragments of that left, you know. But yeah, Gorboduc is the end. It's at the opposite end of the, what we'd call, say, the Bruton, the line of Brutus, which begins in the Lost Play, Conquest of the Brute and is shown sort of setting, establishing itself in Locrine, that comes crashing down in Gorboduc, which is where the, you know, Gorboduc divides obviously Britain between his sons with catastrophic consequences, 50 years of civil war. And that's the end of the line of Brute. So actually Gorboduc, although it's inaugurating something in terms of drama, it's staging the end of something. Mm. It's staging the end of the first, in heavy quote marks, the first sort of, what do you call it, the first British royal dynasty.
Mm. Because it's such a bleak play. I mean, for those who haven't watched any of our exploring sessions, it is a very dark, unremittingly dark play. It's very, very formalized. It's a neoclassical drama, so there's a lot of long speeches. I absolutely adore it. I think it is a fascinating piece of work, and I absolutely
it's fascinating. Yeah,
I think it has legs as a vehicle. It's just it's not a fun evening in terms of, like, there is no humor in the play at all.
Well, there can't be, because it's got to obey the unities, hasn't it? Because it's being written by lawyers who are, that's the priority. You know, Philip Sidney, you know, who dislikes a lot of things about drama or certain types of drama, he singles this play out as being a good play because it pretty much obeys the unities. But he does say even this one doesn't quite do that. And I always find that a sort of strange, you know, most early modern drama completely ignore the unities to the benefit of the drama, I think, you know. But this is what they're trying to do, which is why it's a bit of a slog in certain ways, but if you're expecting a play to do certain things. But it absolutely gets its message across. And what's interesting about Gorboduc is it really engages with historiographic theory. You'll know the theory of posy historical, which George Putnam, amongst other people, put forward, which is, history is important. We can learn from history, so we're allowed to change it a little bit and put words in the mouths of great historical figures, so we can learn from their wonderful example and from their mistakes. So it's all right to sort of to bend and shape and expand the story we're telling beyond the evidence that we have, as long as we're doing it for a really good sort of rhetorical, valid, noble purpose. And that's what Gorboduc, the king, all you get in the actual chronicles is his name. It doesn't talk about him at all. It just says he divided the kingdom. And then what you get is the story of Ferrex and Porrex. Here you get in the play the entire sort of rhetoric, which is of course written by lawyers. This is what they're interested in. The process of good and bad counsel and a ruler ignoring good counsel. That shows how Britain, the Kingdom of Britain, ends up in this catastrophe.
They give it a full psychodrama within the family unit. Oh, you've got him, you've got his wife, the two sons, you've got their counsellors. I mean, you can always feel the two sons that they're actually, when they're being given bad counsel, they're actually just playing computer games and they're really not interested in anything else. But then they get these one, and everything just falls apart, and
it
is that sort of full stop end to in the sense that yes, history picks up again at some point in the future, but kind of after Gorboduc, it's just chaos.
It's chaos, and it's a very long fate period of chaos, and it is the end of the line. You do get a new line because the performance of history never ends. And the audiences know this. They know that at the end of a happy play, you know, they know what's going to come next. It's something like the end of Lear. It's happy because everyone's reunited, but anyone who knows a bit about the history or heard the ballads or read the books knows that Cordelia is going to be dead in a few years. She's going to kill herself because Goneril and Regan's brothers are going to revolt and take the throne. So it's always temporary. The happiness is always temporary. The peace is always temporary. Or the war is always temporary. And at the end of Gorboduc, you do get Monmouthius Dunwallow sort of rising up from the ashes and reuniting Britain, but at the expense of this sort of this particular dynasty. And I guess that's the message that's being sent to the crown or to Elizabeth. That's one theory anyway, you know.
Yes.
You need to secure the,
Because Gorboduc appears early in the reign of Elizabeth, and functions for a series of at the time, very specific political reasons as well for the original event. Because, of course, the script we have for Gorbadok doesn't actually fully reflect the performance of as it was originally performed, because there's at least one scene that has been completely rewritten. Because at the time, it was basically, don't marry this guy, marry this guy, is the explicit point of the performance in front of Elizabeth. And you can do that in front of Elizabeth. You can't print that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there are other little, these plays also, there's some we'll talk about this in a bit, I guess. Locrine does something quite strange as well in relation to Elizabeth, which maybe we'll talk about that in a bit, in relation to female rulership and how it represents or misrepresents female rulership.
I think that it seems like that's a good segue to skip to Locrine. I think we can. Again, that's technically the beginning of the story, as far as we have it, in terms of it opens with the death of Brute or Brutus in the text, and it's about what happens. Actually, one of the weird things about Locrine is that, actually, I was saying the story is, you know, the don't divide the kingdom. Actually, the consequences of dividing the kingdom, though they do it, aren't actually the primary problem of the play.
I'm glad you spotted that. It's weird, strange, isn't it? Because this was used, I mean, Henry, James, this, you know, James VI of Scotland, then James I of England, when he becomes king, when Elizabeth dies, he wrote a book of sort of advice to his son, you know, Basilicum Dorum. And when it was republished in London, when he was about to become king, there's an added passage where it says, you know, don't divide the kingdom, don't be like happened in the time of Locrine. But you're absolutely, and a lot of rhetoric, even in the Lord Mayor's sort of shows and things, or specifically Triumphs of Reunited Britannia, they behave exactly as you're saying, as if Brutus's decision to divide Britain is what creates a disaster, and it isn't actually. It's fine, and then there's an invasion, and then Locrine, you know, has an affair, and his Cornish wife Gwendolyn takes exception to this, and invades him and kills him and everybody else. But that's nothing to do with the division of the kingdom. It's interesting, isn't it? That's how the story is used rhetorically, but actually that's not what happened.
Because when we were reading it the first time in the exploring session, we basically read the first scene and we went, no, don't do it, don't do it. This is how the play's going to go horribly wrong. And then it didn't, and it became a very different kind of drama. I mean, it's doing a lot of work. It's like it's doing the work of, you know, let's name some rivers. which is...
Well, this is...
The naming of things seems quite important for these plays.
It's fundamental, especially in this play. I think because it's, as you say, it's the opening episode, really, or the secondary part sequence of opening episodes of the sort of mythic foundation of Britain, and the naming of things is absolutely essential. That was a sort of an early modern theory that a founder, if you get back and find the person who founded something, on the nature of the person who founded or invented something, that would tell you something about the nature of the thing itself. By that sort of reasoning, the founder of a nation or a city would sort of imbue that place with some part of the essence of themselves. So that could be violent, or that could be noble, or that could be secure, or that could be unstable, or whatever. And it's a really dark, if you look at it in those terms, there's constant references to the landscape, very sort of pastoral language, but also to landscape and rivers, as you say, and mountains and fields and brooks being soaked in blood. So their blood is sort of these, and I think five characters in the play, something like that, give them, probably more than that, give their names to particular rivers, give their names to particular regions, which become the sort of the England, Scotland and Wales and Cornwall and the various rivers. So if it's a story of national sort of foundation, it's a really bleak story because it's founded in fragmentation and blood and death, and some pretty bleak deaths. I mean, one thing that the play does, which I still can't figure out, it's extraordinary, I think, unless you have thoughts about this, is five of the main five deaths in the play, Albanact, who dies in theory in battle, Humber, who's the invader, who drowns in a river in the original chronicle history, Locrine and his mistress, Estrild, and their daughter, Sabrin, who gives her name to the River Severn, all die in different ways in the chronicles. In this play, they are all recast as suicides. It's a really strange thing. which just makes it bleaker and bleaker, and again puts another strange sort of, particularly because of the attitudes to early moderns, to sort of people taking their own lives in the period, which was, there was a lot of superstition and a lot of legal prohibition as well, puts an even stranger, darker sort of tone to this idea of this is where Britain starts happening, this is where Britain is founded in this play. Well, it's
Britain,
not a happy
Britain starts picture. With an invasion that massacres the indigenous peoples, you know, the giants of Britain. And the story of the giants aren't even indigenous either. I mean, that if you go even further back into that narrative, that's a much more complicated story.
Now, with two
as well.
Different threads in that, yeah, it's Albina and her 50 sisters. Yeah, extraordinary stuff. No, yeah, absolutely. So they're all invaders. The Trojans are only recent arrivals. As you say, they've invaded and killed all the giants. And then the play is very confused about whether the next invasion is for Humber, is whether they're Scythians or who they are. It's a little bit muddled. They're just generally, again, heavy quote marks in that sort of early, late 1580s, early 1590s dramatic kind of language. They are the other, you know, they are from the East in some sort of way that's not really defined or clarified or sort of spelled out, but it's there for them to be baddies, really, you know, and to be glorious. I mean, Humber is presented very much in a way that Tamburlaine or someone like that is presented. Mm. He's vainglorious. He's got these huge rhetorical sort of high vaulting speeches, and, you know, but yes, he's the problem. It's not the division of Britain. It's the problem because all the British princes, sort of rulers, unite together to fight him off, and they succeed. You know, that's not the problem. The problem is where Locrine.
The rulers aren't very good. Yeah. They could be united, but if they're a bit rubbish, basically create a series of problems for themselves that they didn't need to have. I mean, it really is a self-inflicted wound. On that sense. Whereas at least with Gorboduc, you have a sense of, you can understand how the politics of the situation works in terms of there are exterior forces as well as interior, and it's a slightly different universe. Whereas it really is just a lot of quite selfish decisions.
I mean, Gorboduc's very carefully worked through intellectually because, you know, because of its origins, you know, and it's very clear, as you pointed out, it's very clear function in a specific location for a specific audience. Locrine is, I think the play's editor said, I think quite rightly, it's pretty much impossible to find a coherent political motive or message in Locrine because so much happens. It's very episodic, and it sends out so many conflicting messages about pretty much every aspect of how a nation might be ruled, or how, you know, ruling class might not conduct themselves. And it's shamelessly playing to, I think, you know, to entertain. It's got a clown, you know, who's Stromberg, fabulous clown, who spoofs the events in his sort of subplot, spoof the action of the play, you know, continually. So it's sending itself up even as it's running.
The memory I have is of our second look where we ran it at pace is that it functions remarkably well as a piece of entertainment. It really is fun. Despite how depressing it is.
It's got ghosts. Well, this is the thing. It is. I guess it's depressing, but also it's very silly. So that's not particularly a good word, but it is. It's incredibly overheated, and there's, you know, there's confusion about its origins, which I think maybe wouldn't be visible to an audience at the time if it was being performed, which I think it would have been, you know, in the public playhouses. It may have origins like Gorboduc in sort of academic or ends of court drama, but if it does, then it's certainly been ruthlessly adapted for entertainment purposes, with Strumbo, with lots of on-stage battle scenes, no adherence to the unities, and some really spectacular, you know, the Humber ends up having food knocked out of his hand by a ghost whilst being laughed at by a clown and starving to death in the British sort of wilderness, and then jumping into a river, and there's two characters jump into rivers, which again is spectacular, and I can presume they would have used the, you know, the trapdoor in the middle of it. One of the first things I will ask my students when I teach early modern drama, I give them one of the dumb shows from this, where a crocodile gets bitten by a snake and falls into a river. And I say, I want you to come up with ideas of how this might have been staged. And the students sort of come up with all fantastic ideas, puppets or costumes or various things. And at the end, I say, well, how do you think they actually did do it? And the answer is, well, we don't know. There's this extraordinary thing on the page of this crocodile and this snake and falling into the river together. We don't know how it was done. We can only speculate. Then it's a little bit like that with the rest of the play.
It does put this notion that the Playhouse drama of the sort of 1590s or whatever isn't visual.
It's entirely visual. Yeah, no. I think in the book you've probably seen this. I've speculated that this is sort of thematic, right? You know, that Humber is described as wearing blue or having a blue sort of flag or sort of standard with silver. Silver sort of lines on it, and I sort of speculate that this is sort of pre-dramatizing or sort of a dramatic irony. He's going to end up becoming a river because he jumps into the river, he drowns in the river, and he gives his name is given to the river, that becomes the River Humber. Mm-hmm. So even the colors of his costume is anticipating his eventual role in history, maybe. But the visual, I think we lose a lot when we read, which is why staging these plays is so important. In terms of the vision, the powerful visual tableau they could present. The last tableau, which I am endlessly fascinated with in this play, is the child Sabrin standing over the bodies of her recently of her parents who recently just taken their own lives, surrounded by an army. Mm. So let's say probably 9 or 10, 12 actors, depending on the day and whether it's on tour or anything else. With the Queen Gwendolyn standing over her, sort of cackling and saying, "I'm going through all the way, she's going to kill her." And this child, it's quite a long sequence. And this child, this obviously a boy actor, performing as Sabrin, stands up to and argues back and talks back against Gwendolyn. But if you imagine the stage tableau of those two bodies, we tend to forget dead bodies on stage if we're reading on the page, but they stay there for a long time till the end of the performance. And then Sabrin ends this by jumping into the river. It's an extraordinarily powerful visual image of unequal power balance between two women that is almost entirely lost on the page if we don't remember how visually striking these plays could be and how important that sense of pageantry and spectacle was, you know, in a way that it isn't. In the same way with a lot of Gorbodog, let's say, because it can't be, because it's a different kind of drama.
Mm. Well, Gorbodog is designed for indoors. It does have dumb shows. It does have visual.
Yeah, of course, absolutely. Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
They're
sort of
segmented in the sense that you have very elaborate dumb shows, but then you have some people standing on stage talking to each other.
But Lacreen also has elaborate dumb shows, of course. It's got I really like Lacreen. It's got absolutely everything, hasn't it? It's got these absurd dumb shows with crocodiles and mythic figures and. Arte, the goddess of chaos and destruction, who comes on and explains every act, and then comes on at the end and gives the epilogue, where she blames, seems to blame Estrild, the mistress, for everything, and she says because a woman was the cause of all that happened here, you know, but she's nothing like the queen, and then sort of apologizes to the queen and wishes her a long life. You know, it's a very strange thing, very strange way to end the story of British foundation. Like you were saying, it's not sort of it's not clear, it's not the division of Britain, something's caused all this chaos, but there's no quite center to it, and the play can't quite decide who it wants to blame, I guess. Mm. Although it does end up blaming a woman, which is typical of the time, I suppose.
Yes, I mean it's again, it's that contradiction of a play that is quite female centric but is also quite misogynistic at the same time.
It's highly misogynist, absolutely. Yeah Although I would say my students really find a lot of interest in Gwendolyn, who is presented as a sort of an excessive female rulers are often presented as excessive and overly violent and thing in the drama and you know the culture literature of the time, but Gwendolyn nonetheless is sort of cheated on and betrayed. More importantly, she is politically disenfranchised and her son is disenfranchised from the royal line potentially, so she goes back to Cornwall where she's from and raises an army and brings it back and conquers Lacreen and reclaims Britain for her son. And in the Chronicles, although this isn't emphasized in the play, she rules for several years in his minority as regent, and the chronicles say that she ruled incredibly well, made good laws, and was a good ruler. The play doesn't say that; it just presents her as this sort of virago, you know. But actually, it's the play is slightly more misogynistic than the chronicles are, which is interesting. Mm.
Locrine, sort of in terms of chronology of production, lives somewhere in between Gorboduc and Lear. Though it's relatively on top of Lear, to be fair. It's only a few years. And again, it's a playhouse drama. But Lear chronologically lives between Locrine and Gorboduc in terms of the story it's telling. It is sort of middle period, I suppose, of the history.
I think he was 10th in line from Bruce or Brutus, I think Lear was, if I remember, something 9th or 10th. It's middle period before Gorboduc.
Again, it's tonally a very different play. It is doing a very different job of work. It ends on a relatively positive note, though, as you noted earlier. Anyone who knows the history knows that stuff is going to go down after the play ends.
That's right.
It's a very light play in so many ways.
It's a delight, really. Broadly speaking, I'm very genre skeptical and genre resistant. At this stage of drama, I know people were naming plays in terms of genre, but seems as often as not to be a sort of publishing tactic, maybe. And Lear, maybe it's called you know the true chronicle history, or the true history of King Lear, and it's also a romance in terms of structure. Lots of things in it that aren't in the, although the story of Lear and Cordelia is actually quite fleshed out in the chronicles a lot more than a lot of the other stories. And you often find that stories that were adapted to plays do have more space, are given more space in the chronicles. So there's more you can lift out and adapt. And there's a lot of there's a lot of direct speech given to Cordelia, Cordella here, for example, in Geoffrey of Monmouth. These sort of full speeches that a dramatist could just sort of come out and adapt. So maybe that's one. This was a hugely popular story in its own right. Anyway, there was a ballad of it. But it's a romance, maybe. There are extra characters thrown in. There's a wicked counsellor. There are often wicked counsellors, possibly to take the responsibility, I think, to take responsibility away from the monarch, but also to show how council works, maybe. There's the King of France gets a lot more of a role in it, and he's got a sort of a roguish, clownish sidekick, who's quite fun.
I should point out, maybe it's more the King of France has his role sidelined later on. Might be another way of putting it.
No, true. No, you're absolutely right. But larger role than he has in the chronicles is I guess what I'm getting at. People get disguised themselves as pilgrims, which is a romance trope. They're the two very good friends. You know, it's a much lighter, and Lear isn't quite, it is relatively just sort of foolish rather than actively malevolent. You know, he comes to his senses pretty quickly. It's a nice play, and it's got comic scenes in it as well. You know, there's quite a few comic moments.
Lear has this sort of double act it's very Last of the Summer Wine esque at times, that his companion are sort of bumbling on, just going, how's the journey going? The sort of middle section of the play is sort of pivots on their relationship and their encounters with other people. I found,
yeah. But it seems to be taken fairly sincerely, and the scene, the reconciliation scene with Cordella, it drags on for ages. Actually, they keep kneeling before each other. One of them stands up and says, "No, you must not kneel before me. I'll kneel before you." And they say, "No, I'm going to kneel before you." And that goes on for quite a while. So there's lots to sort of, be amused by, I guess. And that could have also worked at the time. You know, it's often really hard to tonally read how these plays would have been presented or presented at different times, because it's possibly late 1580s and early 1590s, but it's published again in 1605. At a moment when it's a sort of story of British division, it might have been considered newly relevant, you know, with the new king coming in and James VI and I wanting to bring together England and Scotland and to unify them. So it has a life in print, a good possibly 15 years after it's being performed. So we know it was performed, of course, at the Rose, because it turns up when the Queen's Men, I think, have a residency there. That's right. Mm.
As a Queen's Men play, it fits within a sense of what the Queen's Men repertoire was. Though, of course, we've got to be a bit careful about that, because we don't have that many plays in comparison with other companies as well. I just wanted to just pivot, because you mentioned in passing the evil counselor at the top of the play.
Scaliger.
Scaliger, who just disappears. I mean, it's interesting. He's there to be evil at the beginning of the play, and then you get another evil character who sort of takes his place, but they are distinctly different people. And you'd never hear from him again. And of course, the opening of the play spends quite a long time establishing why Lear is testing his daughters. And the plan, and why the test for his daughters goes horribly wrong. Because, of course, there is political shenanigans going on to make the whole test sort of go pear-shaped.
Well, let's call him Scaliger, I suppose. He's not needed after those first scenes, is he? Because his job is done. He's there. I mean, this is why I get my interest in this play, particularly comes from this idea of this eroding history, this sense of these histories are no longer are becoming untethered from reality or untethered from time in a way. And he sets this sort of wicked or sort of mischievous really counselor sets up and puts the ideas out for the entire love test. It's his idea, as I remember, and he sort of counsels and mentors the wicked sisters in how to approach this and how they can try and get what they want from it, and then he's gone. But what, and this is, if you don't mind, I'm going into this little detail a little bit, his name Scaliger kind of obsesses me. There was in the sort of late 16th century, there were two French scholars called Scaliger, father and son, one of whom was, amongst other things, a literary critic, a bit like sort of Philip Sidney, but even more sort of absolutist about things like the dramatic unities and obeying them, and various other sort of laws, often based on basic humanism, going back to the classic sort of laws on rules on what constituted good literature. And in that sense, naming a character after this figure is quite funny, because the play completely ignores all of those things. So it's throwing him into the middle of a play that he would hate. His son, however, was possibly the most sort of renowned and famous sort of chronologer of the age. He tried to compile by using sort of collating and comparing historical and ancient historical texts and chronicles and timelines. He tried to compile a world history, which he fell into trouble with, because some of his, I think he called it proleptic time or something, some of his timelines to match had to go back to before the creation of the world. But he wanted to compile and to fit all the different national and regional and ancient sort of religious chronologies and versions of history together to create a single timeline. It was an extraordinary undertaking, and he was very sort of admired and respected for this at the time. So again, to name the character of this association between him and the characters is also interesting, because King Lear is absolutely ripped out of its own timeline and would have been experienced in a way by some people watching the play, if they're aware of the sort of the controversy over the truth or not of Geoffrey of Monmouth's history. One particular thing about this with King Lear, with this play, is that all the characters in it are Christian. Or they use Christian language and refer to things like Puritans. They call each other Puritans, and they disguise themselves as pilgrims, like I said. And you can only go on a pilgrimage after in the Christian era. And King Lear, of course, the historical figure, lived, according to the account, centuries before the birth of Christ. So the entire play is sort of subtly lifted out of the timeline it's meant to belong to. So again, having a character called Scaliger or Scaliger seems to me like a little sort of mischievous nod to the erosion and the collapse of things like timelines and chronologies and history and linearity in general. That's just my sort of pet theory, but It's certainly a very odd play in terms of where it thinks that it lives in time.
Yeah, I say it's interesting that, okay, he disappears as a character, but in a sense there's a Batten past because we have a murder plot that again is very, very dependent on fear of some sort of deity, because you have this moment of the murder is in theory about to happen, crash of special effects, again, an effects heavy play in certain ways. And he just runs off and goes, the fear of God is put into him, and he disappears. Yeah, and again, certainly. Basically, he's never seen again. So it's interesting the sort of the incidents and the way it plays with the religion of the play, because
which plays at that time weren't doing. Yeah, you know, they were a lot of religious plays, obviously, but you know, generally, it's you're quite right. It's not they're not the characters aren't just making sort of Christian references, and they refer to saints and things. It's within a Christian cosmology, as you say, the supernatural intervenes, the divine intervenes. Whereas in most other plays, certainly the two we've looked at, Gorboduc, Locrine, and most of the other ones, the characters are constantly calling upon Jupiter. They're talking about burning. In Locrine, they talk about burning sacrifices on their altars. You know, they get married in the temple of forget which god it is, Diana or something. No, Mercury, someone like that. It's a classical world because they're descended from Trojans, so they share the same gods as the Romans and everybody. But this does the opposite of that. And as you say, it's in this one, God exists, you know, or someone who makes thunder. They certainly presume it's the Christian God.
So yes, yeah, so time is moving on in terms of these plays. We're already into the sort of early 1590s. Around the time that skepticism is perhaps getting more rampant, as it were. Does that sort of lead us neatly to the next century, and the oddest of plays that we might call our chaser, our whiskey chaser of Bruton drama, Nobody and Somebody, which is a play sort of set in history, but is it what's its relation to history?
It's such a strange thing, isn't it? It's such a peculiar creature. The historical component of the play, which, I mean, it's named after its subplot, which is actually longer than the main plot, so maybe it isn't. I shouldn't be referring to them in that way. Is the story of Elegier, who's a very obscure king from much later in the sort of the pre-Roman Britain chronology. And the famous thing, well, the thing that was known about Elegier, if anybody, and I've by the way, I when I was doing this research, I would go through eBay, which is an early English books online, doing name checks, you know, keyword checks for the names of all these different rulers. And sometimes you would get hundreds and hundreds, like you might with Locrine, lots and lots of references. It really present in the cult, certainly in the print culture, lots of people referencing, passing references, allegorical references. Elegier hardly turns up at all, really, really, you know, obscure even at the time within those terms. He becomes king three times, I think, because he's usurped by, rather than two warring, it sort of compresses a lot of the things. Two warring brothers get put on the throne, and then they fall out with each other, and they get put back on the throne again. He's a very saintly figure.
What I love about him is the fact that he just wants to go away. He just, don't make me king again. Don't leave me alone. I just want to go over here and be, you know, do nothing and, you know, pray.
Absolutely. He's this very sort of mild, meek character. And then there's, I mean, one through line actually, which we probably don't have time to talk about here, but I'd like to put into people's minds, is the fact that I think almost all these plays have somewhere a Duke of Cornwall, and that there is an extraordinary continuity in how Dukes of Cornwall and Cornish figures like Gwendolyn and Corineus and Locrine are represented. There's a Duke of Cornwall in this play as well, who's very forceful. He's a force for good in this one, or as they all are, often a force for sort of stability and bringing about, even if it's through violence, you know, the status quo. There's a Duke of Cornwall who sort of serves as the grown-up in the if there is one. But the entire story of Elegier and these sort of slightly farcical sort of seesawing or pendulum swinging between different people becoming king for brief periods is the the inherently quite subplot of the title character, Nobody and Somebody, who are there, exist entirely. I'm sure your listeners know this, but the one of the rare playbooks of the period to have a woodcut on the front, which never would have been more expensive, of, it's believed, the actor playing Nobody, the character Nobody, in his costume, which is basically a pair of trousers going up to his neck because he has no body. And on the back or inside, you've got somebody whose trousers somehow start getting, whose belt goes down to his ankles because he's got lots. But the entire, most of the play hinges on that pun, you know, and using it for satirical purposes.
It is a never-ending pun as well. It is like... Every single time, and it was, we had this lengthy discussion, and I apologise to the listeners, these videos aren't actually out yet. I might put them up in the release order, but we have recorded a look at Nobody and Somebody. But it was this discussion of going, is it the kind of joke where it stops being funny and then it becomes funny again because it's just so unrelenting, or is it just these clowns just couldn't stop doing these jokes?
Well, it got published, didn't it? No, it's really, it's relentless. But it's a huge, Nobody, or Niemand on the continent, is a hugely popular figure. And this play, I think this play was translated, one of the plays that turns up in a German translation.
Yeah.
So it's been performed by English companies, probably German companies, on the continent. I mean, the pun doesn't work in Dutch or German. Niemand doesn't mean body. So the costume doesn't quite... I'm happy to be corrected on that, that's my understanding. The satire is, oh, who's been taking care of the poor? Nobody's been taking care of the poor. Oh, that's good. And then Nobody turns up and goes, yes, I've been very busy taking care of the poor. The joke being, of course, that in the society is corrupt and nobody takes care of the poor, nobody mends the roofs, nobody takes responsibility for anything, and somebody is the villain. What I was interested in with this play, in how it relates to this moment you're talking about in the early 17th century, although there is some discussion, as there always is with things, about exactly when the play was written, rather than obviously it was published in 1606, is how, in terms of this slow erosion and the vanishing and the uncertainty around these pre-Roman histories, these figures becoming sort of evaporating from the historical record and from the culture, in ways that were quite distressing or disturbing, certainly for people who believed in them and wanted a particular type of national history. What it means to watch a play with some of these figures, Eligier being the main character, in a play where they're totally upstaged by somebody whose name is literally Nobody. It becomes infectious. The sense of nothingness and nobody and being nobody and not existing becomes sort of, it's not saturating the heavy quote historical story as well. And the prologue to the play runs through with the sort of, I can't quote it directly, but the lines like, who of nothing can something make? Nothing can come of nothing, a line that might be familiar. And it starts out with this idea that they're going to try and make something from nothing, but essentially anything that comes from nothing will always, in essence, be nothing. And I think that's a really interesting and sort of destabilizing context in which to throw kings from this history, just as it's being, as it's under doubt, as it's sort of disappearing from the record and it's being rejected. Because of course, Eligier and Locrine and Gorboduc, they do come from nothing. They're not historical characters, they're inventions. And more in the drama this time, I think the idea of nothingness sort of infects them. And by placing one of these characters, Eligier, and the other kings in it, not just alongside on stage a character called Nobody, but actually having him dominate and upstage them, figuratively, not literally, sort of stages the disappearance of these kings from the historical record. They're being subsumed by somebody called Nobody, who is nothing. Yeah. That's a very sort of figurative, allegorical reading. I think it's what the dramatist would have intended, but I think it's there for people who may have been sensitive to these things and thinking about this type, these stories at that time. You know.
Yes, because there are a fair number of plays from around about this point where shall we say, the comic subplot ends up being the title. Whether it was originally the title is another matter.
But at least
in this case, the comic subplot is substantial in the text, whereas there are some plays where, you know, it's called Blurt Master Constable, and you're just going, he's not in it very much. So the clown had better been amazing to have made that sequence work.
There was extra business
that just never made it into print. Whereas here, it does seem to be that way round.
I mean, there are some little fragments of what I remember from the play of what could be contemporary sort of relevance and jokes. I remember there's a reference to Charing Cross escaping. He's getting beaten up because nobody comes to the city and everybody gets beaten up. And he's that typical kind of, you know... person coming in from the regions into London and sort of experiencing all the corruption and things. And he escapes to Charing Cross. And I do remember reading that Charing Cross was particularly heavily populated in the very early Jacobean period by a lot of people who had come out from Scotland in the wider kind of administrative groups with the new king. So one of it is a slight reference to sort of anti-Scottish sort of sentiment, because there was a lot of anti-Scottish sentiment at the time in London. Jingoistic, English nationalistic kind of feeling. It's a hard play to read for anything other than the broadest kind of general satire about how a society is run, which is relevant, you know, unfortunately, in most times and most places.
Mm. I mean, we are starting to run out of time. Obviously our interest is primarily in production terms, and it has to be said that I'm very interested in this grouping of plays, extant and lost, as a season, because I can envisage, and this is something for the listeners at home to say yay or nay to, you know, do get in touch on Twitter or the artist formerly known as Twitter or any of our social media, or you can email us at admin@beyondshakespeare.org, whether this is a good idea or not, because we're looking increasingly at doing seasons, week-long readings, play readings that we can record for the podcast. And this, as a season, sort of speaks to me, if we're looking at five slots, is you start a week with something based on the material that would have been in The Conquest of Brute. Or something feeding on all the other interlinking stories. Yeah. So you start the week with a sort of a primer on this universe, and then you go through the different stages of Locrine, Lear, Gorboduc, and then end with Nobody and Somebody at the end. Because for all the unrelentingness of it all, the Nobody and Somebody jokes, some of them are actually quite good. And it's quite a fun play.
It's a fun play.
It's just a decision-making process of how much you keep in, how much you trim out. But the shape of that as a season, actually, its discontinuity is what gives it a continuity, I think, because otherwise I think you'd get a bit bored if you got the same tone.
Well, I think you're quite right. And also, I think, you know, in terms of if anybody is interested in how, in the representation of this sort of evaporating, disappearing account of pre-Roman British history, that sequence, Gorboduc starts with the here's some history for you, in very sort of humanist kind of solid, you know, posy historical terms. And to go through that, you know, Locrine does the same but starts messing about with it a bit more. Lear uproots it from time and puts those into the Christian era sort of in certain ways, and Nobody and Somebody is just completely disinterested in any sort of, apart from the title, the genre that's assigned to it on the title page, is absolutely completely escaped and relentlessly attacking this idea of history with the character called Nobody and the idea of nothingness and nothing. So I think that'd be a really nice sequence in that way, and also it shows it does show the development of the drama through, as you say, stories that are broadly thematically quite have a lot in common. They all in one way or another feature questions of the division of the kingdom, the division of Britain, and the consequences of that. They have, apart from Gorboduc, they have strong sort of clown or comic figures. They play through different genres, but they take that, is it, how is that theme represented in different genres? So I think it's a really nice sequence anyway. It's a good little sort of journey through the development of, so you're looking at different, slightly, you're looking at academic drama, Locrine, Lear, as you say, broadly similar, but in terms of time. But I forget where Nobody and Somebody's Believed to have been performed, but it's not at the, say not the Globe, it's probably not these, at the Fortune or somewhere, or the Red Bull, I can't
The
remember.
note
Anyway,
I got is Queen Anna's Men, so
that the Red Bull? Can't remember.
but
Anyway, it's
some
so it's
yes.
so it's a really nice sequence anyway, I think. So you'll see these similar sort of themes cropping up, and I don't think they reference each other, sadly. They don't tend to do callbacks to other plays, or certainly extant plays. But no, it's a really nice sequence with a really broad range of representations of what was believed to be at the time, although increasingly less and less, history. And
And
the sort of founding,
that's where the sort of conquest of Brut Opener is there to do, is to do
Yeah.
the infill
Well, there's
and give you know, because I again ideally what we're looking for is people who buy a season ticket and are there for the duration rather than necessarily people come for an individual play.
Well, there's loads of material on that story. It was a huge, it was a very, very, very significant and powerful story. And for a lot of people, it was the historical account of the founding of Britain, and it gave a lot of sort of some people argue back and say, well, I don't like this history. I don't think there's much to be said for being descended from Trojans, because they were all, one, they were the losers, and two, they were sort of undisreputable in various ways. So two people did sort of resist that, historical writers or sort of cultural writers. But it was such a well-known story. You'll find, if you can look in the Chronicles, but also you can look in Mirror for Magistrates for accounts of it, and it's broadly done in even in Triumphs of Reunited Britannia, and there were so many things to draw from in order to tell that story. And Brut, I mean, it would have been a fabulous play. I think that potentially he has a vision from the visited by the goddess Diana, who sort of directs him towards the island of Albion, and then they fight giants, and then it's his queen Imogen would be there, so that I imagine would be sort of boosted as a character to give a good role for a young boy actor, boy player. So it's there's loads to do with that play. It'd be lovely to hear people talking about that and presenting material in a way that, how was this staged,
Well, yeah, I mean, for the listeners, on the Patreon, I have been doing the Mirror for Magistrates of what the later medieval history, but I will be starting hopefully next year, 2024, going through the expansion pack of Mirror for Magistrates that covers the earlier Bruton histories. So look out for that if you want to join our Patreon. That is exclusive content. At the moment, it is not planned to go out on the podcast. It is behind the paywall. I'm sorry, I have to keep something back. And as it happens, it's Mirror for Magistrates. So if you're interested in that, that will be coming up, as Mirror for Magistrates, I find, is a fascinating book, or books, all on its own right. Though I believe the editorial meetings decrease as it goes on. That's my favourite thing about the first books, is that they basically sit down and have an editorial conference and go, "Is this history or not? I don't know. The two accounts disagree," and I enjoy that more than I do the poems, actually.
Yeah, they can be a bit of a slog, can't they? Is it 1574? The prequels come out, don't they? Is it Higgins? Yeah, and then he sort of goes right back to the start, and they sort of keep inserting extra bits over the years, don't they?
So
And
as I say,
it was a huge, huge influence on Locrine as well. I mean, it was very important to plays like that.
So anyway, we have definitely run out of time now. So this is your moment. Do you want to plug anything? What are you working? You've obviously written the book staging Britain's Past, Pre-Roman Britain in Early Modern Drama. It is available in good and also presumably very bad bookshops now and online. I said it was reassuringly expensive. It's actually for this kind of book, actually retailing at a decent price. So if you are
It's in
interested.
paperback as well, so that's probably why that is. It came out in paperback a while back, so yeah.
And it is very readable and accessible. I enjoyed it a lot. But
Thank you.
that's me. But anyway, any other things you would like to plug or put out there in the world?
Let's have a think. Yes, I'm well my interest in sort of popular culture, which is and sort of popular drama, which is broadly where this took me, is continuing. I'm now most of my work is now on romance drama. where obviously a lot of these romance and ideas of history and what was true and what wasn't constantly blended and blurred together in this period. So there are some interesting crossovers. But I am very interested in looking at lost plays and how the story, how prose texts were adapted into drama. There's a lot of that, obviously, with the Chronicles in what we've been talking about. But in romance, we have these extraordinary sort of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of word romance texts in translation, sort of across the sort of coming out of the medieval period and across the, and they ended up as being plays. A lot of them are lost plays. So I've been researching that towards a book on my primary obsession, I think for nearly 10 years now, which is Musidorus, which is right, which was what I wrote my MA dissertation on and my first article. And I'm contracted with Arden to write a book about Musidorus, as the most in print and in certain other ways in terms of, you know, passing references and other sort of evidence. Potentially one of the most pop, certainly the most printed play of the early modern period, but a play that seems to reach into, that's been very under-examined critically, but seems to reach into all areas of English society and performance, from the royal court to being performed during the interregnum by rural workers or sort of in Whitney. It touches on everything. So my aim is to use Musidorus to tell a sort of parallel story of early modern drama, and where it decenters authorship, which decenters professional drama often, or certainly London-based drama, to look at performance in sort of different areas beyond London, to look past the sort of early sort of Jacobean period. It goes, there are performance records of Musidorus going all the way up to about 1699. So I want to tell a parallel story, and I'm using Musidorus as a sort of through line to bring in other overlooked plays, amateur plays, regional performance, and a bit, and the way, because Musidorus was often staged by non-professionals, so the way that putting on a play within your own community could allow you to take on new roles. So I'm going to be writing about lots of other exciting plays that don't get written about much. The Apprentices of London, various lost dramas, Guy of Warwick will pop up a lot. Yeah. Things like that. So each chapter will focus on a different moment in history and use a character and an episode from Musidorus to bring in some of these other dramas that were sort of peripheral to the professional drama or to what could sort of critically acclaimed drama in various ways. That's what I'm working on at the moment. I'm also, sorry, I'm going to have to say his name if I'm going to plug this. I'm writing a new introduction for the Oxford World Classics edition of Cymbeline. And that should be out next year, I think. So that's what I'm up to anyway. Thanks for asking.
Yes. Anyone who'd like some Musidorus action, we've done a first and second look exploring sessions on the play. The second look fast-paced run we did without the additions. But the first look, I think we did look at the additions as well, as we tried to decide which we preferred.
What did you decide?
I personally prefer it without the additions. I think it's a tighter text. I think the opening works better, and revealing the surprise, as it were, right from the off, I find quite unsatisfying personally.
I agree. Yeah, I'm curious. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have a favourite?
Yeah, I mean, I like the more subversive version, which, as you say, is the one where it's not flagged that he's a prince at the start, so you don't find out till the end. It makes sense why they wanted to sort of diffuse that when it was reshaped to be performed at the royal court. Although there is evidence that it was performed at the royal court or was certainly revived before that, because in the second quarto there's a reference to the king. I prefer it without those things. I mean, you do get a bit more mouse, I think, a bit more clowning in the revised edition, which is, you know, mouse is like very similar to Strumbo in a lot of ways in Lucrine, actually. Again, possibly written at a similar period, and we don't know anything about the authorship of either place, which throws up all sorts of interesting questions for another time and place.
Yes.
I do like the other version. I do, yeah.
And it's also one that's very high on the list to return to. It fits very nicely in the season, so it's very likely that if we do continue seasonal work, where we're looking at a mix of plays, that's pretty it's pretty doable, I think, as well.
It's an incredibly streamlined and astute piece of work. I've spent far too, you know, years looking at it, and it's usually dismissed as being, even by people who are interested in writing about it, as being essentially pretty, you know, clunky and incompetent. And I got to say, in certain ways, I disagree. In certain ways, I do agree. But I work, you know, it does a lot of very interesting things, particularly visually and dramaturgically, in terms of the use of doubling, the thematic use of doubling. So that's something I certainly want to focus on in what I'm writing about. But again, when people like yourself are performing these things, that those things tend to come out more than when it's being often read and written about by you know, and I've been teaching it, and certainly by the students, I wasn't sure how they would take to it, because it's, you know, it's not poetic in the sort of accepted sense, but my students have had a lot to sort of think about and talk about and write about with it. And Mouse is very popular, which is always nice.
Yes, I mean, it's a question that we often get. You know, what makes a good play? What are the ingredients? A lot of it is sometimes just down to taste, and what you want a play to do. But anyway, we are going into drifting into areas that we just don't have time for. Mm-hmm. I think that would be for a future discussion, when that book comes out. Well, all that remains is to thank my wonderful guest for being wonderful. Thank you very much, and goodbye.
Thank you for having me. Take care.